This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Tara LaMasters, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. If you don't mind, please take a couple minutes to complete the listener survey. You can find it in the show notes. There's a link. I appreciate any feedback you might have. This is episode 112 for March 2nd, 2021. On this day in 1776, Americans began shelling British troops in Boston. On this day in 1836, Texas declared independence from Mexico on the 43rd birthday of Sam Houston. In 1853, what eventually became the state of Washington was organized as a U.S. territory. In 1865, Abraham Lincoln rejected Robert E. Lee's plea for peace talks, demanding unconditional surrender. In 1889, Congress passed the Indian Appropriations Bill, putting unassigned Oklahoma land in the public domain, which before had been Indian territory. In 1901, Congress passed the Platt Amendment, limiting Cuban autonomy as a condition of the withdrawal of U.S. troops. In 1917, Congress passed the Jones Act, making Puerto Rico a U.S. territory and its inhabitants U.S. citizens. On this day in 1930, the novelist D.H. Lawrence died of tuberculosis. In 1946, Ho Chi Minh was elected president of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. In 1956, France granted independence to Morocco, and in 1973, federal forces surrounded the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, which was at that time occupied by by members of the American Indian Movement. Today, in 1904, Dr. Seuss Theodore Geisel was born. It's also the date of birth of Chris Martin. The actress Bryce Dallas Howard was born today, and on this day in 1950, Karen Carpenter was born. So this episode features a therapist named Tara LaMasters, who has been a friend and a colleague of mine for many years. And I feel like we did a great episode, had a really satisfying conversation, which I hope is helpful to some of you out there. So here we go. Tara LaMasters.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye.
Take your Tara, how you doing?
I'm doing really good tonight, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, too. We talked a little bit before we recorded. It's inauguration day, and I'm relieved, and I just walked my dog. I live in a high-rise, and coming back in, everybody's happy. You know, it's not just me. People seem relieved.
Relieved, yeah. a new spirit, some new energy.
Yeah.
So,
we've been ready for it, I think.
Hope, every day we wake up, it's another day. An opportunity to change and have hope and move forward. Mm-hmm.
So you and I go back probably 13 years.
Yeah.
Sounds about right, doesn't it?
That sounds about right. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
So, you're a therapist. Mm-hmm. And what are your credentials?
I am a licensed practical clinical counselor now in the state of Ohio. And I did live in Florida. That's where you and I met. And I am a therapist in private practice, and I'm also a coach. I have 2 advanced degrees, 1 in organizational psychology and leadership, and then the other one is in counseling psychology. Hmm.
And then you have some specialized training too, don't you?
Yes, I do. I have postgraduate training or training as a certified sex addiction therapist through ITAP, and I also have a designation of certified sex addiction therapist supervisor, which means I can supervise others who are becoming CSATs or certified sex addiction therapists, and I have training in relationship trauma and in trauma from Pia Melody of The Meadows.
Yeah.
She was a co-founder of The Meadows. So I obtained that training during the time when she actually trained therapists. So I feel very fortunate, that I learned from her.
Yeah. So yeah.
That learning and that process was life-changing for me personally and professionally.
Yeah, well, her first book, Facing Codependence, I probably, I was about 14 years 16 years sober when I actually read that book. Mm-hmm. And of course I'd known about it for a really long time. And, but it's a really powerful book. It changed my life. And I recommend it a lot. I think especially to guys, well, because that's who I tend to work with, but also because it's really concrete.
It's very concrete.
And it's this is where it comes from. This is what it looks like. This is how you pass it on. You know,
this is where it comes from, how it looks, how it shows up. This is how you pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pia also wrote another book called Facing Love Addiction and another book called The Intimacy Factor.
Mm-hmm.
And also rooted in all her work, it's also what we would call theories of attachment,
mm-hmm.
and theories of childhood woundings and traumas and relational traumas and all of those things. And really, when you step back and consider when she wrote those books, is that she was a pioneer in kind of bringing that out into the light, into the forefront.
Mm. Well, and she was a nurse, and it was like a very observational process.
Right.
That this is what she saw.
And what she noticed in her own life and what she noticed in others.
Mm.
And what she noticed at that time in the patients and the clients at the Meadows.
Mm. I've talked about this a couple times on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Working in the helping profession myself, especially in the addiction treatment part of it, that term codependent gets thrown around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a label. It's a label that's used, and I feel like not always the most constructive ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of become a little bit of an axe that I grind, mm-hmm. especially because, I had been working, I'd worked in treatment for years and years before, someone who was a spiritual advisor to me in my life mentioned to me that there were 5 core symptoms to codependence.
Uh-huh.
I started to realize how often you hear this, and it's often from people who are living out those core symptoms, and it's like they have no personal insight into their own codependence, and it's almost mm-hmm. weaponized the way they use it to describe clients in a not constructive way, in a like talking down their nose sort of way. Like,
well, in a more of a one down way.
Right. Right.
That there can be a tendency to go one up and then go one down on others.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those symptoms, it was just such an eye opener to me. I guess especially the symptoms related to experiencing one's own reality, the inability to experience one's own reality.
Right.
And then to experience one's own reality moderately.
Mm-hmm.
The whole black and white thinking thing is, those aren't the types of things that when all those years I heard somebody called codependent or somebody tried to explain to me what it meant. I guess that's my point. Most of the people who you hear using it, they can't really tell you what it is.
Well, yeah. And I agree with you. And a simplistic definition can also be when we as human beings put others' needs ahead of our own at an expense to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a broad brush stroke definition. but that also applies. And going back to what you said is to experience my own reality in moderation. That's really difficult, especially in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I think it's become even more difficult with social media and the demands on people's time, relationship, image, all of these things contribute to that. And it is a spiritual practice to be moderate.
Hmm. Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And a lot of addictive behaviors, compulsive behaviors can kind of sneak in there when we are not moderate as human beings. They provide relief, yeah. Relief from what's going on in my head, relief from my reality, relief from my anxiety, relief from my depression.
Fatigue.
Yeah. And also takes me out of my own reality that also can be untreated trauma.
Mm. Yeah. So what made you decide to become a therapist? Was this always the plan for you or?
I'd say there was very little plan. It just evolved. Earlier in my life, I worked more in a business and sales setting, that kind of career path. And then I worked as a consultant and a leadership coach. And I continue to do some of that. And there's some crossover with that. And I find that rewarding. And then through my own life's journey in therapy, and then a family member who got into recovery, and one of their first stops on their recovery path was the Meadows. Mm. And when I attended the family program, I was finishing up my second graduate degree, and I heard Pia Melody speak and Patrick Carnes speak, and what they talked about really resonated with me, and I could relate to it, and it made a lot of sense. And I thought, you know, I want to know about how to deliver this message to help others.
Hmm.
So that's what started me, you know, on my journey. But becoming a therapist was not something that I set out to do at, you know, like age 20 or anything like that. It just kind of evolved through my own life's journey. And one of the aspects of what I try to teach others in their healing process, regardless of what they might come and talk to me about it first or present to me as their problem or their struggle, is about setting boundaries.
Hmm.
Because boundaries help make us relational. And if I have no concept of where, you know, I start and end and you begin in a relationship, we're in trouble from the beginning. And boundaries, you know, don't always look like what people at first glance might think that they are. Most people have a pretty good idea what physical boundaries are, but emotional boundaries are set with talking and listening.
Mm. Well, and I think a lot of people probably oversimplify the concept to meaning saying no.
Mm-hmm.
When it's, you know, it's really, there's an aspect of it that it's teaching people how to treat you, you know, and part of it is saying no.
Exactly.
Part of
it
is
saying no. And it can be saying no. It can also mean, or end up sounding like, no, not right now. I need to think about that. I need to get some more feedback. Mm-hmm. It's not always black and white, kind of circling back to what we were talking about earlier. There's a degree of moderation in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if we need help with that, you know, just kind of inherent to being someone who mm-hmm. doesn't have functional boundaries kind of means you're surrounded by people who don't either. So it becomes, it can be challenging to institute them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But once you do, I mean, it's one of the things I love about it is it demonstrates how we are really responsible for our own happiness.
Yes.
It really does. Because once you start to, you know, well, here's an example. Saying no when I mean no rather than saying yes because I don't want to, you know, that, all that. And,
right.
you know, all the emotional yes turmoil that comes with, well, I don't want to do this. Why did I say mm-hmm. it? You know, and, you know, people do that all the time, right. do stuff like that.
And I'll say yes because I don't want you to get angry at me, or I don't want to hurt your feelings, or I don't have any right to say no, or I'll say yes because then I can in turn manipulate you
right.
into, you know, doing or saying or the delusion of being what I want you to be for me.
Right.
All of those things.
Yeah. And, you know, there's one of the things that about boundaries that is, you know, I don't know that I've learned over the years is there's also an element of it that people instinctively know if mm-hmm. they can walk all over you and they don't respect you.
Mm-hmm.
And owning that power. You know, often we're afraid, well, if I don't agree with this person about, then they're going to reject me.
Right.
And it's often the opposite is true because if I'm not authentic with you, you know that.
Right.
You instinctively know that. And you've already rejected me
mm-hmm.
on some level, right?
On some level.
Yeah. And then there's no hope for moving forward because there's not mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's, I'll never forget a compliment somebody paid me one time. It was, you know, back when I was at the facility where you and mm-hmm. I met, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it was outside contractor came in and did work with the guys every week. And
mm-hmm.
she said to me, you know, they always know where they stand with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me feel really good to hear that and to get that kind of feedback. And
yeah.
And that, you know, to be that type of person. Well, and also, let's not kid ourselves, it's a lot easier to do with clients than it is in our own personal lives.
Well, sure, and it can be, you know, I hear what you're saying and the compliment that, you know, that person paid you is they were able to witness and observe how the clients would respond to you.
Mm-hmm.
And also when the relationship is closer, we have more at risk emotionally.
Right.
So if it's with a partner, spouse, parent, child, there's more at risk.
Mm-hmm.
The more emotional closeness that's there, there can be more at risk in setting a boundary. And the boundary doesn't have to be a wall. It doesn't have to be harsh.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is where the attachment stuff comes in with the PMLD work, because if you are able to have secure attachments, then this isn't a concern, right? It's like, you're not worried about whether this person rejects you or not.
Right.
You don't need them. But if you have insecure attachments, if that's because of whatever took place in your childhood, whatever set the stage for your, you know, the cycles you live out in your relationships, then it is. It's, you know, well, if I don't behave a certain way, then I'm going to risk losing this.
Yeah, I'm going to risk losing approval, losing love.
Right. And you know, like, so essentially what it ends up boiling down to is you're not really living, you're preventing abandonment. That's what you're, right? I mean, that's
well, it's a survival mechanism to attempt to prevent abandonment.
Right. And again, it's another going, it doesn't work. It ends up doing the opposite.
It ends up doing the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And also there's this tendency to respond and be much more impulsive when I don't have boundaries. It rather than, what I meant to say, Tom, is be much more reactive than be responsive. Because when I have a boundary, I can pause and respond.
Right.
When I don't, I'm reacting, and I'm reacting a lot. I'm reacting based on what you're saying or not saying, what you're doing or not doing.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have a boundary, and if I set an emotional boundary, that is, you know, through talking and listening, and you, the other person, you're sharing your reality with me, and can I listen to that and say, is that true for me? Is it not true? Do I need some more information? Do I need to think about it some more? Do I need to get some feedback from others before I share with you, you know, my response or my reality?
Mm.
And many people will just react.
Mm.
And they live in a constant state of reactivity.
Mm.
And reactivity is also anxiety provoking, because we have an epidemic of anxiety.
Mm. You know, just to, like, if you're listening to this and you're wondering why we're talking about all this stuff, one of the things, aside from just hearing people's stories and the idea of them living out their authentic path, one of the things that I've also wanted to focus on is the obstacles to personal authenticity. And I don't really think there's a bigger one than codependence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it. It is like it's faking it. That's really what it is. It's not being who you are, and not being true to yourself. And so it is. This is. I like this because we're going like really deep, and we're right there together. But it's this is important stuff, you know, and it's stuff that most people really. This is the kind of stuff we need to be teaching kids in schools.
Absolutely.
And I think, in most cases, instead of it happening that way, it happens like I learned about this stuff in treatment for my alcoholism, you know. I mean, things are already way off course. That's how I, you know, where and I don't know, I think you think other cultures are better at this than we are, right?
Maybe to varying degrees. And I also think it's the human condition.
When you say that, what is the human condition?
Difficulty being moderate. And that, you know, in our culture, if you have the privilege of having your basic needs met, and anything above that, right, is that therein lies, you know, this difficulty in, I think, controlling our impulsivity. Social media drives impulsive behavior. I can have anything I want at my fingertips, you know, attention, products, you know, expressing myself, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, and back to the anxiety, it's, you know, when we're used to having everything at a moment's notice, like one of the things I'd watch my little boy when he was little, like he'd have an iPad and, you know, just kept when it's, you know, the thing is it's loading and it's not the hourglass or the circle or whatever it is that it's loading. And he just keeps tapping it and tapping it, you know, like it's supposed to be now,
faster. Yeah, why isn't this loading any faster?
Yeah.
Dad?
And then, you know, you and I mean, until I was, I was using a rotary phone until I was 20 something, you know, and, and just the, I mean, you know, we don't even have to learn phone numbers anymore. And, you know, that I just think about dialing that rotary phone, you know, you turn it and then it turns back, goes back to neutral and then you turn it again. I mean, at least seven times. I mean, and it's like, it's it takes time. And so then when we're engaged in something that doesn't happen immediately, it's a source of anxiety because we're so used to having everything right now.
A source of anxiety, frustration, all of those things. And also, you know, concepts of mindfulness kind of go hand in hand with moderation, right? Because to be mindful is about being present and being in the moment, and where, you know, the intellectual mind and the emotional mind intersect is in the present. And really being mindful is all about being present. And so much of our attention can be consumed by, well, what am I going to do next? And I have to do this and I have to do that. And you can live, you know, your days day in and day out, not being very present in your own life. So meditation is really a powerful tool that can harness that. So meditation and moderation kind of go hand in hand in that way.
You know, one of the things that my over the last few years, my eyes have been open to is the idea of, like, you know, when we've gone through adverse circumstances in life, being attached to that story and the idea of we are not, you know, I am not my story. And that's I don't know, that just seems like a big one to me, that that's also like a another way we can be less than ourselves by being so caught up in our history or our story or our beliefs that, you know, we don't really even know who we are.
Well, I agree. And I also believe there can be elements of untreated trauma
trauma that's not processed, and that keeps us hooked into our story. Mm-hmm. Then the story in itself creates like a safety because it's known.
Right.
And if I detach, if I let go of that, then who am I and what do I have? Mm-hmm. How do I define myself?
Yeah. I'm drifting.
Right.
Yeah. Here's something I'll ask you is mm-hmm. I've seen online, and I might have mentioned this to you in another conversation, just sentiment out there about the word trauma being overused. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, not everybody has trauma. Like, you know, some people think everybody has trauma. That's a crock. Not everything's trauma. And mm-hmm. when you say, you know, this, you know, not getting the little red wagon was trauma, then you invalidate the people who actually have trauma. Do you feel like it's, I started my career at a time when people were really just beginning to talk about trauma in the context mm-hmm. of chemical dependency. So I've kind of, that's part of, you know, I guess my identity and my careers. That's when I came into this. And, I mean, I see how it's relevant, mm-hmm. but what do you think? Do you think, I think there was overcorrecting, right? Because right. finally we recognize it. So maybe we're thinking we see it more than that. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think it's somewhat complicated. And again, in the spirit of moderation, I think that we have to be cautious, with much of the overcorrection, is the way that I'll state it, is that if trauma is relative to that human being mm-hmm. and that human being's experience or that person's story and history, and it is traumatic to them, then who am I to say that it's not?
Right.
And from my perspective as a therapist, as a helper, as a healer, as a coach, whatever role it is that I'm serving in the capacity with that client or that other human being, I do not view that it's up to me to judge that. Mm-hmm. And I think you can get into a, you know, very slippery area that, well, you know, it's not trauma, and trauma needs to be reserved for those that really have very, you know, the more severe trauma, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, the stuff I've seen, it's, you know, it's from a psychologist online who, you know, basically when she perceives it kind of as quackery, or the practitioner is doing you a disservice if they're telling you this is trauma, that kind of thing. When, mm-hmm. you know, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's a word.
Well, it's a word, and it is an experience
right.
for that human being.
But I mean, the word is the label, how to describe the experience to mm-hmm. help the person understand
right.
the experience. That's mm-hmm. the point of it. And that's why it is subjective, mm-hmm. right? It's about the person understanding themselves. And if you, it's I don't know, you know, like the disease concept of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I look at it, whether it's true or not, I mean, it's a useful framework with which to look through, because it helps people. I think to some degree the whole trauma thing is useful in that way too. And
if the trauma framework helps someone to understand their history and the events and their reality, then that works for that human being.
Right.
You know, versus, well, trauma should be reserved only for this, and it's quackery if it's not.
Right.
You know, from my therapeutic stance, I don't look at it as that black and white. If others choose to do so, you know, and that's the stance that they take, then, you know, that's their choice.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, part of the reason it stands out to me is because, you know, reading the Pia Melody book and beginning to understand, you know, my origin story and what happened in my life. I remember I was at a professionals weekend for a facility out in Palm Springs a number of years ago. And the medical director there, he's the guy, I can't remember his name, but he wrote the book, The Velvet Rage, if you remember that. And he talked about invalidation. And something he said that I, you know, is that, you know, when we're systematically invalidated, that's trauma. And I just never even thought of that. And, you know, I've had that experience. I had it in childhood in some instances. I've had it in adulthood, you know, that repeated invalidation of, you know, your thoughts aren't important. And it's, you know, almost never stated directly. It's more behaviors that reinforce the sentiment, you know?
Yeah. It can be behaviors, it can be words, it can be nonverbals.
Right.
Dr. Alan Downs wrote The Velvet Rage.
Did you Google that book while we were talking? Or did you know?
I knew that his last name started with a D.
So yes, you Googled it.
Yes, I did.
I have
I wanted to honor him because it is a phenomenal book.
Yeah, maybe I'll put a link to it in the bio.
Yeah.
Yeah, impressive guy too. Yeah, that was Michael's house.
Oh, I remember that program
years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Palm Springs. Have you ever been to Palm Springs?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I like it too.
So beautiful.
It's beautiful. I like the climate.
Yeah.
In the winter.
It's kind of mellow too, you know. It's you can walk around. It's not, you know, it's hour from LA, but not LA, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
and you know, that invalidation, Tom, is that Pia talked about it so much, in that to invalidate a child's reality is traumatic. To invalidate a child's feelings, reality, you have no right to feel that way. That's not how you feel. That's not what you saw.
Or don't feel this.
That's like, right.
Don't
that's
cry.
Not how we do things in this family.
Right.
You know, all of those kinds of things. And circling back to trauma, I also think that it's important to mention that, you know, it's again this framework, right? You can have big T trauma, and that's abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, witnessing traumatic events. That can be big T trauma for sure. That is big T trauma. And then there can be little T trauma. And that's what we're talking about over and over again, the denial of what your reality is, a denial of your feelings reality.
Right.
And that's insidious, and it erodes a human being.
Yeah. And, you know, what happens is when we are taught that, sooner or later, we no longer need anyone to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
We just invalidate ourselves.
Right.
You know?
We invalidate ourselves. And, you know, that's where addictive behaviors and avoidant behaviors and all those things start to creep in.
Wow. So, what's on the horizon for you? Any big goals or anything? I mean, have you ever thought about writing a book or anything like that?
I have, and maybe I have one book in me within the next 10 years. But I, you know, my passion really is helping others. And, I work with individuals and couples and families. And I also really enjoy and have a lot of interest and passion around doing intensives for individuals and for couples and with families.
And so when you say intensives, describe what you mean to someone who doesn't know anything about this stuff.
It would be meeting with clients in a condensed period of time, perhaps around a specific traumatic issue, a life event. It could even be goal setting. I've met with clients that, you know, have sold their businesses, and then it's like, what's next in my life? So focusing with that individual, maybe a couple, deciding, are we going to go forward together? Or if our marriage ends, and then how might we end it in a way that's more constructive, especially if we're parents? And then with families, especially when there's been addiction or fracture in the family system, is meeting with the family over a condensed period of time, maybe 3-4 days, to really process the feelings of each family member or each, you know, a party in the coupleship, and have a deeper level of healing to move forward.
So that's something you that satisfies you, doing that.
I think it's very rewarding.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, when you have someone who's, you know, in more acute distress, okay, your time's up at the end of an hour, you know, I mean, that's not always, it's not always the best thing, right?
And it can be for clients that are in acute distress emotionally, and it can also be super helpful in healing and provide this platform and trajectory for growth when there has already been some healing work done. How do I take it to the next level? Is there residual that I need to clean up? Those types of things.
So, you know, here's... People don't understand therapy, right? I think in general, we have this, I think the the prevailing belief in our culture is there has to be something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I don't know, having been exposed to it, I mean, I began to see it as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I could have like looked down on myself for needing it just never made sense to me to do that. Like, if there's someone who knows more about life or whatever, then why wouldn't I want to talk to them?
Right.
And if they're an expert, why wouldn't I be willing to pay them? Mm-hmm. But the stigma associated with it, you know, what do you tell the person who could probably benefit from therapy, but they're reticent for whatever reason, or they don't know how to think about it? One of the things I tell people mm-hmm. is, you know, if you're just dipping your toe in the water, go with a goal
mm-hmm.
and tell the therapist, this is what I want to get from this, and work towards that end. Well, you know, that's a place to start.
I think that's a very positive place to start. And with clients that I work with, usually, you know, the first session, definitely by the second session, I begin to engage them in their own process.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope to gain from working with me?
Mm-hmm.
What are some goals that you'd like to accomplish mm-hmm. in our work together?
Well, and it's an opportunity because we go through life, you know, just with so many stimuli, and
mm-hmm.
we often don't take the time to think about that stuff.
Well, I agree. And I also am a therapist, a coach, a guide, a healer, whatever title that, you know, you care to give me in your process, I'm all good with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that the client needs to engage in their own process, because mm-hmm. it's not about me sitting there and listening and just telling them this, that, the same thing week in, week out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very rewarding for me.
Yeah.
So clients that I work with tend to want to be on a healing path of some type.
Mm.
They are either in acute distress from relational trauma, usually, and they want relief and they want somebody to listen and help them process and unpack their feelings. But over time, clients that I work with tend to want to be on a healing path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to, in order to invest the time and emotion and to stick it out and to keep showing up. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. It's work. But, and I think I've said many times, I think that for me, one of the real advantages I have had, just as a person who needed to find recovery,
mm-hmm.
is that I'm fascinated by this stuff. I'm intrigued.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not someone who thinks, well, why would I want to have that kind of, you know, I love talking about this stuff. I, the idea of understanding better what makes me tick. I mean, I'm interested in that.
Right.
And not
fascinated,
everyone is.
Fascinated and intrigued and an inherent curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I agree with you, because I am curious about other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the moment that I lose my curiosity and I forget that somebody is really allowing me to come into a very honored and sacred space by revealing things to me that often they've never revealed to anybody. The minute that I forget that, then, you know, I need to readjust myself.
Yeah.
Because when we share about who we are and our realities and our histories and all that, it is vulnerable and it is intimate.
Yeah. It's scary for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I feel the same way. I mean, I feel like it's a privilege.
Absolutely.
To do this work and it, you know, just to be at a place in someone's life when, you know, it might be the worst period of their life that they've ever experienced and they need to change, want to change. And, you know, we get to be there to, you know, just be present or to usher them through it to some extent and let them know it's okay. Mm-hmm. Like you're not the only one.
Right.
And you're gonna be okay. It is. It's a gift. It really is. It's,
And to hold that safe, and it is a sacred space emotionally for others to begin their healing process.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, back to the inauguration thing and where we've come from in this last period of time to have a president who shows emotion and, you know, last night there was this, you know, the memorial service they did on the National Mall for the 400,000 people, Americans who've died for the first time, really. This been going on 10 months. For the first time, really, that it's acknowledged the tragic, you know, loss of life
due to this pandemic.
But to have a president and an administration that is willing to recognize it. I mean, talk about invalidation, you know. Pretending it's not happening or pretending it's not as bad as it, or it's a hoax or whatever, you know, but it just feels so much better.
Right.
Now it just does. It just does. And it's an acknowledging sadness.
Right. It's acknowledging sadness and it's acknowledging grief.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, with a leader can acknowledge their own vulnerabilities in that way. Is there strength in that?
Yeah.
And that gives others hope.
Yeah. 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 Well, we're headed in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pretty good about it. So this has been great. This has been a lot of fun. And I'll just ask you, you know, the question that I ask everyone at the end.
Sure.
If there was a time in your life when, you know, the younger Tara needed some support or advice, when would that have been? And what would you say to her?
I would say, you know, when I was an adolescent, probably. And, you know, into my earlier 20s, that it's all going to work out. And your life will be an adventure that you never planned on. But wow, is it going to be rewarding?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's inspiring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah. This has been fun. Thank you. I knew it'd be great because we always have good conversations.
Yeah. It's my honor.
Yeah. Well, we'll be talking soon, right?
Absolutely. All right.
There you have it, Tara LaMasters. You can find the podcast and subscribe, like, follow, whatever it is they have you do at Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Patreon, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher. And you can hear the show on YouTube, as well as, I'm sure, many other places out there. If you enjoy listening to the show, please take the time to leave a rating or a review or both. If you have an Apple device, please do it at Apple Podcasts. If not, Podchaser is a great place that would be helpful for you to leave a review there or wherever you listen. If it gives you the ability to do that, please take the time to leave a review. If you know someone who would enjoy this episode, another episode, or the show in general, please share it with them. On the website, I try to make that really easy to do. If you have questions or comments, you can call and leave a voice message at 561-247-4757. I'd love to hear from you. Appreciate any feedback you have to offer. For early access to the newest episode, as well as unedited interviews and other supplemental content, you can support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you can hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to our sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox. Path to Authenticity is proud to support the iSpeak Media Foundation. If you haven't checked out the website, please do, thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can learn more about Tara LaMasters there. I have a blog with all sorts of stuff on it. Lots of info about all the guests, most of the guests. Anyway, I put a lot of time and effort into it. I hope I want to make it, you know, I'm just trying to turn this into some kind of community here. You know, I want to engage you guys. I actually got a text from a former guest this afternoon telling me an old friend of his who he only speaks to occasionally happened to listen to our episode and stopped using drugs, found a therapist, found recovery. It's been clean and sober for 6 months. And at the end of the day, there's really nothing more I could hope for than just helping someone out there somehow with this show. So, thank you for listening. Thanks for taking the time. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. You can find a Saturday playlist and a Sunday playlist on Spotify. Links in the show notes for all of this. Hope you guys have a great week. Be nice. Thank you.
Hey, we need a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.